are four basic geographical areas when we talk about Rishonim. The first one.
Okay?
Say again?
Are you okay?
Yeah, I'm fine. I actually have a slight cold. I woke up, whatever. You know, it's Spain and North Africa, which means from Egypt, straight across North Africa. That's one geographical area. And as I told you guys already, and I guess I'll tell you again, in case you forgot, that was all Muslim.
That's impossible.
It's impossible that you would have forgot that, right? That was all Muslim. In terms of what was going on, there was the least amount of persecution in these areas in the entire time, by far. I wouldn't say, in modern conception of freedom, et cetera, it's inaccurate. You know, like you may see sometime here or there articles, books, debate. You know, some people say, well, the Muslims did persecute the Jews. Okay, no one, I don't think anyone really doubts that. But if we, look back at, society at large 1,000 years ago, then Muslim society by and large was smoother for Jews than Christian society. That is a fact. I don't think anyone really debates that. But I haven't looked at the latest controversies in some time. So we'll see. I hope. I don't think tonight. I think next week. Spain itself is a little different, and we'll get to that. If not this week, next week. Okay, the next major area is, of course, Ashkenaz. When we talk about Ashkenaz, we're talking about north central France and Germany.
Gaul?
No. Because France, southern France, which is known as Provence, or province, is something else. We'll get there. They're our third piece. But northern France, which is from even northern France, Paris, etc., moving over all the way through to Germany. But this is the Rishonim period, which means 1,000 to 1,500, approximately. This was where the Jews were most persecuted, had the most difficulties.
Christians, right?
Yeah, Christians. And I don't know, any of us aware, Ellie, no, please no answering, Crusades in Jewish history? We're aware of that, what they were in Jewish history?
Where?
Crusades?
Where?
No, Crusades. Crusades are Western Europe. Say again?
Turkey?
Crusades, no. The Crusades. Crusaders. The Crusaders came mainly from France, but also a little bit from Germany. And they had moderate success in fighting Muslims. They had major success in fighting Jews.
Oh, really? Shocking.
Of course, the Jews didn't have an army.
Let's just go kill innocent Jewish villagers. They're in France.
Whatever. Okay.
Go all the way to the Middle East. See them in the backyard.
Yeah. Whatever. Anyway, so Ashkenaz, the Jews suffered the most constantly over and over and over. And then we go on to southern France, which is Provence. P-R-O-V-N-C-E. And geographically, as I hope we know, I forgot to bring the maps in, but hopefully we realize this, southern France is geographically close to Spain, and because it was geographically close to Spain, it was culturally influenced by Spain. I'm not able to absolutely substantiate this, but the feeling one gets from the Rishonim is that it wasn't as difficult. They didn't have the amount of difficulties that the Jews had.
Close the door.
But there is a certain, as we'll see, Spain, even Muslim, purely Muslim countries were even better, most likely better. I saw, what's his name, Hirsch Goldworm, says, and I'm not this. I'm very personally. I would have to double check this to see if he's right, because I've caught him on historical mistakes. He says that there was a period of time that the count or duke or whoever it was of Provence was also ruling was also ruling Barcelona, and was actually Spanish. So I'm not sure. I personally have to verify that, because I have caught him on other historical errors and things like this. So could be not. But there's no question. What there's no question about is culturally, in a Jewish and even non-Jewish form, there's you know let's see, Catalan. Catalan? No? You know what Catalan means? Catalan is a dialect of Spanish spoken in northeastern Spain. People who Barcelona is the key city in Catalonia. And I don't know languages, I'm not a linguist at all. Don't know Spanish. I took French in high school, not Spanish. But linguists say that Catalan is heavily influenced by French. And southern France is called Languedoc, which is also a slight linguistic difference than northern France. And there's clear reason to you know, there's definitely a connection between southern France and others, Provence and Spain. And the Jews there wouldn't say they had all the opportunities and was significantly less persecution. They had, as much less they had in Muslim countries, but it was a little smoother. Italy is the fourth area. Italy is interesting. As we may know, the popes ruled a large part of Italy. And it definitely, I'd say in the second half of the Rishonim era, were the main power in Italy. In the first half, there were the Angvinian kings, emperors, who were very interesting people. They really ruled southern Italy more than northern Italy, and most of the Jews were in northern Italy.
These were Christians?
Yeah, the Angvinians were Christians, but they were
Catholics?
There's only Catholics then. But the Angvinians were, you know, they were like the precursors of the Renaissance, and they were heavily influenced. You know, Sicily went back and forth. I remember reading in I think it's a biography of Patton, but it's hard to remember where that one of the cities, Sicily has been, there's cities in Sicily which have been conquered, being conquered like 75 times. because it's right in the middle of the Mediterranean. It's off of Italy, in the middle of the Mediterranean. And at this period in time, it went back and forth between Muslims and Christians a number of times. And culturally, southern Italy and Sicily were influenced by Muslim culture. And as mentioned before, and we'll mention again, this is, quote, the golden era of Muslim culture. And the Angvinian kings were influenced by the golden era of Muslim culture. So, but Jewishly, it was there weren't that nearly as many Jews in southern Italy as in northern Italy. So, you know, most of the ones we know of are from northern Italy. In northern Italy, you're dealing more with the Pope and little dukedoms and whatever you would call them, you know, feudal entities. And therefore, as a result of all of this, the popes have had historically as rulers a funny relationship with the Jews. They never expelled the Jews. There were expulsions from almost every single place in Europe, but never from Rome.
Well, they needed them theologically, no?
Yeah, they needed them. Yeah, some people say that.
Was Italy part of the Crusade? I'm sorry, I don't know this.
Italy was not. No. That's a good point. No, that's a good point. The Crusaders may have come through Italy. It's probable they went through, but you don't want your own soldiers rioting, killing people in your own area and plundering them. Again, that's your own business. But when you're in someone else's territory, that you have to keep your soldiers more. Jews in Italy were not affected by the Crusades the way Jews in France and Ashkenaz
were. Are there a lot of Jews in Italy at this time?
It's hard to know. All these issues are big question marks. The first accurate censuses are in the 1500 area, and we don't really know. No one knows absolutely. I mean, there's approximations. I know, for example, we have approximations of how many people lived in Castile, which is the main part of Spain, from, you know, Ferdinand, Isabella, and on. But they're approximations. They're amount of households who pay tax. But, of course, you have to assume that X percent, you know, if today in civilized countries, let's say, there's a, I don't know what the percent, everyone's counted for. How many people pay? How many people getting out of paying tax completely who should be paying tax? 10%? 5%? 10%? Something like that? Mm-hmm. I mean, you have to assume in very early modern society it was a lot more than that, you know? you just have to assume that. So no one really. These are big, big question marks. I was reading something really interesting. I can't remember what it was. Okay, whatever. Okay. Those are our four main areas. And it's important to realize, as I mentioned before, that Ashkenaz and France, Tsarfas and Ashkenaz, France and Germany, had tenuous contact with the other three. Spain, North Africa, were Provence and Italy were in good contact with each other. But Ashkenaz, it was tenuous. We'll go on and I'll maybe mention something, just a really classic example of it. Okay, the Rishonim really begins with a famous story called The Four Captives. Historically speaking, when you went to war, one of the things you were trying to do, besides kill people, was capture people. Because if you capture people, then you could hold them for ransom. Jews were good captives. Because Jews, even if they weren't, you know, there were people who, and for example, the Hundred Years' War, who made big bucks capturing, you know, high-ranking officers, noblemen, etc., etc. Well, you know, a foot soldier was not worth anything and just killed him. But every Jew was worth something. Because Jews are always willing to pitch in shvuyim is a big thing. Yeah. You're talking militarily?
Yeah.
That is not so deeply embedded in Western ideals and culture. That is definitely, you know, in the Japanese, it's like, you know, surrender is, they ki'ilu think, the Japanese pre-Second World War thought, and in the Second World War thought, ki'ilu, if they surrendered, they lost their chayel kolom haba. That's what they believe that.
That was the concept of kamikaze.
Yeah, that's what they
meant. Well, kamikaze, kill yourself.
Kamikaze is a little more complicated than that. But it was ki'ilu, I lost my chayel kolom haba. That's not really a Western idea. That's not a Western idea. Okay. So Jews were good captives. And if you had the good luck to capture a rabbi, he was a really good captive. Because people were going to pay a lot of money to get him out of jail. The four captives, it's unclear from what I was able to see if they were all going together, but they were going to collect money for the yeshivas in Bavel, probably Rav Haigon, but maybe it was still Rav Shiragon, because all the episode happened between 980 and 1000. That's when the episode happened.
What happened?
What happened? So four major rabbinic figures were captured, and they were redeemed in four places. Now we only know three of their names, but legend says there were four. The first one was.
These are you said they were.
They started out as shluchim, as emissaries for the yeshiva of Sura
and
Pupatita,
right?
Those are in Babylonia. Those are in Iraq. They were going to collect funds for the yeshiva in the traditional Jewish manner.
And they got caught.
And they got captured. The first one's name was Rav Moshe ben Chanoch. He was captured and brought to Spain. Rav Moshe ben Chanoch. He was captured and brought to Spain, and no one knew exactly who he was initially. They thought he was, you know, he didn't let on that he was anything special because he didn't want them to, you know, like, raise the ransom. And some Jewish person redeemed him, and he was serving as a simple servant in the person's house. And, okay, so he was there, I don't know, a week or 2 weeks or whatever it was. And he went to shul. The rabbi was saying in Russia. The rabbi was saying a drasha. Someone asked the rabbi a question, and the rabbi says, "I don't know." So Rav Moshe Mechonoch sitting in the back. You know, the poor people sat all the way in the back. He's sitting all the way back. He raised his hand and asked if he could answer. He answered, and the rabbi, who's said to be someone by the name of Rav Nosson, could be, but it's not really a known figure, was able to see that he was clearly, you know, that Rav Moshe Mechonoch was clearly his superior in learning. And at the end of the session says, "I resign my position, hire this man. He's much, you know, much greater scholar than me." And that's a famous story of Moshe Mechonoch. He started a yeshiva in Cordoba. And there's
Cordoba?
Cordova. Spain.
Where the Rambam was.
The Rambam was later going to be from Cordoba. And this is the beginning of, you know, real level Torah scholarship in Spain. Until this point, Spain was dependent on any real questions. They had to send the question to Babel, to Babylonia.
Did they have Gemaras then?
Like, of course they had Gemaras.
Yes, Talmud Babli?
Yes, they had Talmud Babli.
Printed?
No. Printing press, Gutenberg, is in the 1370s or so. But yeah, they certainly had Gemaras. But don't forget, they didn't have Rashi.
Okay,
Seder, but without that, but the Gaonim lived in Babel, and if he weren't a Gaon, as the Rambam writes, the Rambam in the Hakdama to the Mishnah writes that if you ask someone, a rabbinical person, to say a pshat in the Mishnah, so most of them won't be able to answer you on the spot, because you have to know a couple of Daf Gemara to know what pshat in the Mishnah is. And most people are not going to be able to give you, you know, immediate, absolute recall on the spot.
But was
that Taurus is like the hardest?
The Rambam was he at the same time as Surah and Prophet?
No. We'll get there. The Rambam. We'll get to the Rambam in 100 years. We're not going to get to the Rambam this week. I don't know if we'll get to the Rambam next week. I'm pretty sure in 2 weeks we'll get to the Rambam. The Rambam is going to take at least 1 week, if not just not even 2 or 3. The Rambam is stormy. Rambam is very stormy, and I have a lot of things to say about him. Yeah, as I said, I've told you guys, the Rambam is the second most controversial person in Jewish history. So,
who's the first?
David HaMelech. Okay. Fine. So, this is a major watershed for Spanish Jewry, having Rabbeinu Moshe ben Chanoch there. The second... Of the four captives was Rabbeinu Chushiel. Rabbeinu Chushiel was redeemed in Tunisia, in a place by the name of Kerouan. I don't think we have anyone from Tunisia here. I don't know if the city still exists. If it's, say it's a minor city, but he was redeemed in Tunisia, and when Bezer Hashem get to his son, he started a yeshiva. He was considered a major. He was considered Rav High, considered him a competent, you know, halachic authority, who he recommended people to ask, which is very. That's like a real haskama, and he's most best known for his son, the Rach. Rabbeinu Hanano and Bezer Shem will get to the Rach. We'll definitely get to the Rach.
Who was the name again? I missed the name.
Chushiel, Rabbeinu Chushiel.
His son is the Rach.
His son is the Rach on the side of every Gemara. Here you see.
What did Rabbeinu Chushiel do?
You see this?
Yeah.
Rabbeinu Chushiel taught. He learned and he taught.
Where?
In Kerouan. Kerouan, Tunisia. In Kerouan, Tunisia. Okay, the third of the four is Rabbeinu Shmaryo bin Elchanan. Very little known about him besides that he went to Egypt, started a yeshiva. It has. I really thought how long I should spend talking about the Karaim, the Karaites, and I decided not to spend too long, because if we spend doing the Karaites right, it would at least take 1 week, if not two. And I want to have at least a solid chance to get to more modern times this year, you know? The reason why Rabbeinu Shmaryo ben Elchanan is important is because, in case you're not aware, the Karaites had a lot of In the Rambam's day, before the Rambam came to Egypt, they were the majority of Jews in Egypt were Karaites. The Karaites Kroim, Kraim. They're people who deny the authenticity of Torah Shabbat Peh.
And that's Tzedukim.
Very briefly, the Tzedukim are from the Mishnaic period, and they disappeared at latest the year 250. The Karaites arose in around the year 700 as the result of a question who should be the next Reish Galuzim, around the year 700. From the year 700 until around the year 1200, there are major players. And today, if you could find, if there's 500 of them left in the world, I'd be surprised. There might be 500, maybe 1,000, maybe. But the Rambam was the one. Rabbeinu Sadia and the Rambam were people who fought the Karaites. Rabbeinu Sadia was only briefly in Egypt. And one is definitely assumes that without Rabbeinu Shemaryahu ben Elchanan coming to Egypt and starting yeshiva, then the Rambam 100, 150 years later would not have been to come. The Rambam came and successfully wiped them out, more or less, because of the Rambam's breadth of knowledge across the boards. So that's why he's important. In other words, without that, it's like interesting to theorize. I mean, Egypt was... it's factual, it's historically factual that there was a small Jewish community in China. Are we aware of that? It's historically factual that pre-modern times there also was a small Jewish community in India. But because these Jewish communities were so far away and out of touch with the mainstream of Judaism, they're halakhically questionable what they are today. And we don't know, in other words, one has to assume the vast majority of the people have slowly but surely assimilated. It's an interesting historical theory, what would have happened. In other words, Egypt is like too much in the middle of the Middle East to for such a thing to happen, but it's not impossible. It wouldn't have been impossible. But the facts are, though, because we have Rabbeinu Shmaryahu and we have the Rambam and others, the Kroim, the Karaites in Egypt were defeated. Yeah.
Question. So
these people that were
so disconnected from you,
say,
like people that were residing in India and China, are they part of possibly the
Ten Lost
Tribes?
The Ten Lost Tribes, controversial.
Yeah.
I don't think... See, the problem with the Ten Lost Tribes is the proofs are all not that clear. There is a basic fact that we know for 2,000 years, we could substantiate for at least 2,000 years, the Jews always have close to 100% male literacy. That's a fact. Jews have had, it's documented in Shas, who started, quote, Jewish schools, and it's just a very integral part of being Jewish is at least knowing how to read. It's a very integral part. And it's just very hard. It's hard to... It's hard because of that, and that none of these supposed lost 10 tribes even know Hebrew. It's funny. It's very funny. Whatever. Let's just leave it at that. Let me just, spew a historical, fact at you. Assyrians... Assyria is Ashur, northwestern Iraq. There are still, let's say 3% of Iraqis are Assyrians, and they still speak Ashurit, which is closely related to Hebrew, and they use letters which look quite like this. Okay, that's 20. Assyria as an organized nation has been dead for 2,600 years, okay? There's some Muslims, some Christians. They're not some Muslims, some Christians. So, if there was a group of Jews who maintained a communal history somewhere, then it's just hard to understand how they lost Hebrew. I'll just leave it at that. Let's leave it at that and go on. Okay. I just want to do a really quick run through the Bali Dikduk. They're very important. I was just speaking to Eric about them.
Do we know? We have no idea anything about the fourth captive.
The fourth captive is anonymous. He's unknown. But the legend says there were four. That's the legend. I didn't have time to track down what I would call primary source for this legend. But that's what the legend says. Okay. The Bali Diktuk. Now, we're all English speakers and we're all American. And English, Diktuk, is grammar. Grammar in English is a really bad word. It's like, really bad. Amongst English speakers, people who enjoy mathematics usually don't enjoy grammar. Because English grammar is arbitrary, pedantic, and all sorts of other...
Nonsensical.
The real historical facts are, this is interesting to know, there is, linguistic analysts will tell you there's a certain amount, they really will tell you this, a certain amount of grammar is logical. No, there is something called universal grammar. There is a certain amount, yes, but it's important to understand in English that a certain percentage of the grammar and certainly the spellings, correct spelling, the concept of correct spelling in English was invented in the 1600s to show who's educated and who's not educated. That's like the curveball of English.
It's kind of true.
What?
If you look who speaks properly.
Okay. You're sort of right.
Americans doing another curveball by trying to separate further.
Okay, you're right. Webster said, okay, the English tried to didn't get it right, I'm gonna simplify it better. And that's why he took he took use out of also a whole slew of words.
Change the
R. This, that, yeah, he did a whole bunch of things, and fine. Okay, anyway, but in Hebrew, tiktuk, proper word tiktuk means exact. It's a definite fact. Mid-doc-dek is to be exact. It's a definite. I've quantified this. My children agree with me. Israelis who are very good in math are also usually very good at tiktok. The ones who really enjoy math really enjoy tiktok. And I know a number of math. It's hard to know. It's hard to know. I haven't done serious math in a long time. I know a number of mathematical geniuses who are like, they foam at the mouth over TikTok. That's how excited they get about it. Especially in Tanakh.
TikTok
and Tanakh
is like
Nikudot
and stuff?
TikTok
and
Tanakh
as well? Spelling,
Nikudot. It's not just Nikudot, it's just a Nikud, it's also Trup, Tama Mikra.
And spelling.
All of it. It's all together. It's all together. One big system. It's one big system, and it has mathematical accuracy. And I told you, mathematical geniuses, like they like foam at the mouth. They get so excited about it.
So they put. Hold on. There was no Trump in the Chumash before these guys.
Okay. It's Machlokes and Gemara. Mikela. I think right in the beginning, but if not, it should be over there. If the Trump was instituted by quotes. Anshe Knesset Gedola, or the Trump is quotes Halacha Moshe Sinai, which means it was always there. A guy I had over my house about 20 years ago claims, I don't know anything about this, I'm just spewing out a fact someone once told me, that ancient Greek, the key difference between ancient Greek and modern Greek is ancient Greek had Trump, Ki'ilu. And the Trump, and the time, and Ki'ilu, you understand, the way someone intoned it could change the meaning, which is also true in Chumash. So don't have no.
Language.
Say again.
Meaning basically, is it something in everyday language?
Yeah.
No. I thought there were people who instituted. I thought it definitely was instituted by people. The Trump wasn't.
Well, the Trump is mentioned. Let me be blunt with you. The Trump is mentioned in the Gemara. It's mentioned, the Gemara talks about it, so if less than 2,000 years old, it can't be.
Right.
Okay? And anybody who's going to try to tell you that the Bali Masara, the ones who put Trump in the Psukim, is just wrong. What did the Bali Diktuk do? The Bali Diktuk were the ones who wrote the first dictionaries of Hebrew. They codified, they wrote down in a systematic fashion, in a systematic fashion, rules of Hebrew grammar. That's A. And they also made the first dictionaries. The first one is Rabbeinu Menachem Ibn Saruk. Rabbeinu Menachem Ibn Saruk has his sefer is called Machberet Menachem. And that is the first dictionary of Hebrew, written around the year 960. Machberet Menachem.
This is the Menachem that Rashi always quotes.
There you go. This is the Menachem that Rashi always quotes. You see Rashi, when Rashi wants to talk about what a word means, he quotes Rabbeinu Menachem. Rabbeinu Menachem's, I don't know if we call him antagonist, protagonist, colleague, person who disputed Rabbeinu Menachem is Rabbeinu Dunash. Rabbeinu Dunash Ibn Mabrut, who's best known not for that, but one of the Shabbos Niros. Anyone know? Dror Yikra. It was written by
Rabbi. What's his name? Dudash?
Dunash. Dalet Vav Nun Shin.
You know why.
Well, I know people sing Dror Yikra to all sorts of things.
Oh, no, everyone in LA at least does it. Snoop Dogg, Beach Boys. Dror Yikra. Have you heard the Beach Boys song? Have you heard that?
Critiqued Rabbeinu Menachem's Machberet, wrote Hasagos, wrote his critiques about it, and today when you buy it, you buy them together. You buy Machberet Menachem with Hasagos Dunash. And that is more or less, I wouldn't say it's definitely not, I wouldn't accuse people later of just rehashing all the same arguments, because I definitely would not do that. We're not talking about college professors who have to publish her parish. Talking about real people who are dedicated to Emmaus. So I'm definitely not going to say that.
Were
Rabbeinu Menachem and Rabbeinu Dunash creating the Hebrew language? No. They were codifying it. The Hebrew language consists of, I would say, two main bodies of knowledge. One body of knowledge is Tanakh. That's one body of knowledge. The other body of knowledge is Mishnah. Mishnaic Hebrew is not quite Tanakhic Hebrew. The Rambam, fascinating little quote from the Rambam, Nesakdama, to the Sefer HaMitzvos. The Rambam says he could have written the Yad HaChazaka in one of three languages, or maybe one of four. I definitely remember three, and I don't remember if he says the fourth. I could have written it, he says, in Tanakhic Hebrew. I could have written it in Mishnaic Hebrew. I could have written it in Arabic. He picked Mishnaic Hebrew because he felt it was the broadest and will allow him to most clearly do what he wants to do, which is codify Jewish law. But Tanakhic Hebrew exists.
Doesn't he use Arabic for his other course?
We'll go wait till the Rambam. Hebrew is a language that exists.
So was he writing it for people in the future? Like
you're talking about the Rambam?
No, I'm talking about the Bali Diktuk.
This is the golden era of Arab culture. And this existed, dictionaries of Arabic existed. So they felt that was a good conceptual idea. So let's do it to Hebrew. And that helps you when you have a dictionary. When I have a dictionary, that is a very, very key. If you don't know what the words mean, you don't know what you're talking about. That's like the most key building block of any learning.
Where do they get their base of knowledge?
The base of knowledge is going to have to be interrelated usages from Tanakh itself.
Mishnaic Hebrew,
no one doubts the Mishnaic Hebrew is strongly related to Tanakhic Hebrew.
But it's
not exactly the same, but it's close enough related that a person can bring proof back and forth from the next. And of course, Aramaic. Aramaic is very closely related to Hebrew. And there's good questions on the exact relationships between the two. And this is what these people were dealing with. They were defining the language in terms of understanding it. And saying what the words mean. Very key, very clear. These are basic building blocks of how you learn Chumash.
So
how you learn. It's not Mamish, a parish, or Chumash. It's a dictionary which will assist me to learn Chumash immensely.
Rashi quotes it as a parable.
Yeah, of course. He quotes it because when Rebbeinu Menachem is trying to explain what a word means, he's going to bring a pasuk and deal with it.
So what exactly codified like the language? Like obviously, like Hebrew didn't come until like Eliezer ben Yehuda or whatever. Like the language that the Ritzba and the Rashba, all of them were using. So was this like
okay? What language did the Rishonim use?
Yeah.
The Rishonim use Rabbinic Hebrew. Rabbinic Hebrew, I wouldn't say it's a total constant, because it's not a total constant, but Rabbinic Hebrew from the Rishonim and on is somewhere between the Mishnaic Hebrew and Lashon HaShas. Lashon HaBavli. The Lashon HaBavli, I would say broadly, broadly, Lashon HaBavli is 2/3 Mishnaic Hebrew, 1/3 Aramaic. That's about what it is. It's not. If you don't believe me, open up your Yerushalmi and you know what I'm talking about. The Yerushalmi is almost pure Aramaic. Pure Aramaic, go to the Targum. Now there are different nuances in Aramaic. You know, there's this and that, okay, whatever. Don't worry about all that right now. There's different nuances in Aramaic. But if you want to see pure Aramaic, go to the Targum. Targum, etc. All these Targumim, that's pure Aramaic. Clear? Anything else about the Bali Tiktok? We're all clear about it? Okay, let's go on. Let's at least get Rabbeinu Gershom Moro Gola. Okay, now, the four captives all were staying again, basically in Sfard, North Africa. We're not sure if the fourth one ended up in Italy or not. There's no reason to say that he did. But they brought real Torah to Spain and North Africa. How did Torah get to Ashkenaz? That's a big question. And now, we definitely know, without question, the Rabbeinu Gershom Mor Hagola is the beginning of Torah in Ashkenaz, basically. Now, there's someone, the question is, who did he learn by? That's the real question. He definitely learned by someone in Ashkenaz. The big, big question mark is, did he actually go to either Rabbeinu Hushil's yeshiva or Rabbeinu Haigal's yeshiva? Because Rabbeinu Gershom Mor Hagola lived from 960 to 1040. And as we should recall, Rabbeinu Haigal died in 1038. Rabbeinu Haigal was a generation older. Rabbeinu Haigun died at either was 95 or 98. So Rabbeinu Haigun was a generation older than Rabbeinu Gershom. He's a generation he precedes Rabbeinu Gershom by a generation, even though they died around the same time. So there's a lot of.
What is the full title of Rabbeinu Gershom?
Mor Hagola, Light of the Exile. Rabbeinu Gershom Mor Hagola started a yeshiva in Mainz. Mainz is on the Rhine. It's like right over. It's
Germany.
Not far. It's in Germany. It's in Germany.
It's between Germany and France.
No. It's right over the border. It's not far from France at all. Mainz.
It's the whole World War II. That's in World War
I. No. That's Metz. You're thinking about Metz, not Mainz. You're thinking about Metz. Metz is in Alsace. Metz is in Alsace. But at this point in time, this whole area was really considered German, not French, for the records. It only became French much later.
No, I understand, but I'm saying it's like right in between both of them.
Yeah, it's right in between both of them. That's right. It's right in between both of them. Now, of course, the most famous thing Rabbeinu Gershom is known for is not marrying two women, which is why we Ashkenazim don't marry two women.
Why did he make that takana?
Legend has it he had two wives, and he felt it was too difficult, and he felt it was too difficult for anyone else also.
He made that decision
as far as we know on his own. And because he was an undisputed rabbinical leader, everyone accepted it.
Even the...
No, Ashkenazim.
Oh, okay.
All Ashkenazim accepted it. There is, you know, just like, let's step back a minute. Now, can a person marry more than one wife if the first wife doesn't want? If you're married to whoever. And you want to marry someone else.
Technically, according to halacha, or?
Technically, is there any halachic reason not to marry the second woman without the first one's consent? So, that is a major question. I'm not sure if it's machlokes rishonim. There's definitely machlokes in midrashim about it. And some learn that was what was going on in Megillas Rus. The Targum on the Megillah, on Megillas Rus, says that's why the guy, originally Rus was supposed to marry some unknown person.
Plony.
Right? Plony Almoni. And he says, I can't. Pen Ashlus is not Klossi. I'll destroy my inheritance. I'll destroy my house. So Rashi learns one way. We're not going to get into Rashi now. The Targum says, I won't work with my wife. Now, Chazal actually, the Midrashim say that Ruth was an unbelievably beautiful woman, so one could of course obviously figure out why his wife probably wasn't interested in marrying Ruth. Okay? But you see from there an early Makor that it's not just, if you think that pre-Rabbanic Gershon, that you could just go marry as many women as you want, it's not that clear at all.
Where did the Spartans stop?
Svardim, even today, theoretically, could do it.
It's in the Ksuba, I think.
If they write in their Ksuba that they're not going to, then they obviously can't.
What about you,
that's a separate issue.
Two more things with Rabbeinu Gershon. Let's keep that one to that. Okay, the second big thing about Rabbeinu Gershon is a cherem, which is not as well known. I mean, everyone knows that if I send someone a sealed letter and you're carrying it, you're not supposed to open up the letter.
Yeah,
but Rabbeinu Gershom says, a cherem, if you open it up, you can be excommunicated, thrown out of the Jewish community. Okay?
I've heard that all this comes with some relation with the advent of more modern cities.
I'm not sure if I would agree with that, because this is...
Something about...
I don't know if I agree with that.
People being more crowded and stuff like that.
I don't know if I agree.
What's the third one?
Okay, I don't quite remember. Okay, now. Again, Rabbeinu Gershom's chief accomplishment.
Aren't there three Tikkunos of Rabbeinu Gershom?
There may be. The Chidot did not list all of them. So I don't know. Rabbeinu Gershom's chief accomplishment was he started a yeshiva, which brought real Torah on a real level to Ashkenaz. In other words, we have the four captives bringing Torah to Sfard, we have Rabbeinu Gershom bringing Torah to Ashkenaz, so now the Jews at large, and the world at large, outside of Bavel, are no longer dependent on Bavel. He was considered, I didn't write down the quote, but he was considered by Rabbeinu Hai as an accomplished scholar who you can ask questions to. And that's the beginning of Torah outside of Bavel. And this is very key. You know, I couldn't find this, and I emailed someone to get it, and I forgot to check my email today to get it. But, yeah, I'm sure we're familiar. We should be familiar with Mark Twain / Samuel Clemens' famous paragraph about the Jews.
Of course,
right? There's the Babylonians, and these guys. These guys, they made a lot of noise, and they're gone. What's going on? Jews are there and there.
Is there like a Machlokes?
What is and his
face?
I don't want to get into. Not Jewish anti-Semitism is not for now. Let's just get this quote at 7 o'clock already to keep up with last year. The last year's tradition will go over a minute or two. You can leave. You want to leave? You can leave. You're gonna have to wait tonight for dinner anyway.
What?
You're gonna have to wait. Okay. Mark Twain concludes that what is his secret? And you want to know what the secret is? The secret, as the Rambam says, the secret is the Jews are connected to Hashem. They're quoting a pasuk, and I don't quite think it's in Malachi, Ani Hashem Lo Shinisi, Atam Mishol Kirisen. Jewish continuity is connected to the existence of God. And the vehicle through which we connect to the eternal Nitzchias of Hashem is Torah. And that's why, in a real sense, what kept things moving and allowed, you know, Jewish history to go on at the beginning of the Rishonim to start was the real founding and starting of real Torah outside of Babylon, outside of Babylonia. It was just...